Right, we're ready to go. Okay, so welcome to Bio 241. This is a lecture right after your second test. And that means it is October 22nd, but I better check my watch to see if that's true, but I believe that is true. Yes, the 22nd. Hard to believe. I don't think we started sensory chapter yet, did we? I don't think we did. So we're going to do that today and maybe even next time. And then we get into the endocrinology system next week. For sure we'll do that. All right, so your exams are graded and they're in Blackboard. If you don't see your score in Blackboard, then I lost your Scantron. And you might have to take the test over again. That's not funny. You maybe put your Scantron in the wrong pile. All right, and I just wanted to get everybody's grade on there really fast, so I didn't have time to go around and search for everybody's Scantron. So remember, when you're done with an exam, and I know our neurons are really fatigued after an exam, but please try to put your Scantron in the correct lab period, and that just makes it really smooth for me and everybody to get their grades fast. When did you get your grades, by the way? Same day?
Same day.
Well, okay. Well, it can't be much faster than that. So, anyway, I would like your help. Just put it in the right pile. And let's see, was there anybody that gave me a different name? I think everybody in this class used the right name. That's also very helpful. Okay. All right, any questions on the schedule? When is the next test? I guess I had a question. So today's the 22nd. Oh, you're not seeing anything, huh? You should be able to read my mind by now, no? Most helpful? Okay. There's always something there. It should be coming out pretty soon. All right, so today's the 22nd. Your next exam is going to be 1, 2, 3 weeks away from today. That seems pretty fast. Maybe the other one was 4 weeks, something like that. And the chapters, okay, the chapters, I'll just have to tell you as the projectors warm up, the chapters are going to be 10, which is sensory, 11, 12, and 13, which is endocrinology and muscle, and blood, heart, and circulation. Wow, we're getting really into the heart of some physiology now. That's fantastic. And we're going to be using all those principles that we learned so far, all that nifty physical chemistry, and what you know about receptors and signal transduction pathways. Oh, that's even better. Okay. All right, so let's start talking about the sensory chapter. Unless you have a question regarding the test or schedule, we're pretty good. Nice. All right, so I'll just put that away. And here is the sensory chapter, sensory receptors. Remember, in a closed system in our universe, you can't create or destroy energy, but it can be converted from one form to another, right? And sometimes when we convert energy from one form to another, we say it's transduction, right? So you transduce information or transduce one form of energy into another. And I think I mentioned at one time what the language of the nervous system is. What's the language of the nervous system? It's just action potentials, right? It's just a blip. And depending on where those blips go, you have a different perception. And depending on the frequency of those blips, you have an appreciation of intensity. Oh, it says right here, common language of the nervous system, right, are action potentials. And action potentials, all right, are something that other forms of energy get transduced into. I got to get my cursor going. Okay. All right, so each kind of receptor responds best to a particular modality of energy. For instance, the receptors that are most sensitive to light are photoreceptors in your eye, and the receptors that are most sensitive to sound are in your ear, but you might be able to perceive other kinds of energy. For instance, with photoreceptors, if you get hit in the eye, you probably see things that really aren't there, and that's because you're depolarizing some of those photoreceptors with extreme amount of force. And different modalities of energy are perceived as being different, right, because of where those action potentials go in the brain. So if it's a light signal, what part of the brain does it go to? You probably remember that from anatomy. What part of the brain does visual or light information go to? There's a particular lobe of the cerebral cortex. It is the occipital lobe. Yeah, that's really good. Maybe you learned where sound action potentials go to, the temporal lobe. Yeah, so we'll talk about all those different lobes. And if we were to stimulate the occipital lobe, or we were to hook up your ear to your occipital lobe, what would be the perception when sound hit your ear? This is a pretty good question. What would be your perception? Okay, we would take those neurons away from the temporal lobe where you perceive sound, and we take those neurons and take them to the occipital lobe and hook them up. What would be your perception when there was sound in the room? Okay, you would not hear that information, you would see that information. It wouldn't make any sense, but you would have a visual experience because how you perceive things is due to what part of the nervous system is being stimulated, what area. And if the occipital lobe is stimulated, it's a visual experience. If the primary auditory cortex of the temporal lobe is stimulated, then you'll have an auditory experience, for instance. All right, so that's what this statement here means. Different modalities are perceived as different because of different central nervous system pathways that they stimulate, and it takes them to different parts of the cerebral cortex. Most signals have to go through a relay station before they get to the cerebral cortex. From anatomy, does anybody know what that relay station is? Okay, the relay station to make sure that auditory information goes to the temporal lobe. Okay, that visual information goes to the occipital lobe. Okay, and that is the thalamus. I was going to say hypothalamus. That's not right. All right, so it is the thalamus. That's the relay station. And so if that gets messed up, then you will have different perceptions or misperceptions of things. Sensory receptors, we can classify them by what they are sensitive to, like chemoreceptors can monitor chemicals, like the pancreas can monitor blood glucose levels. Photoreceptors transduce light into, what does a photoreceptor transduce light into? It transduces light into action potentials, okay, which, and you know the basis of an action potential, membrane potential changes. Thermal receptors respond to temperature, right? All of these things right here are pretty easy to appreciate, I think. Proprioceptors, however, might be a little bit different. Proprioception has to do with special receptors that you have in all skeletal muscles and all tendons, and they can measure tension, right, and the length of a muscle, those two things. And your body is keeping track of all your muscles and tension and all your tendons all the time via these proprioceptors. And if there is a wrong amount of tension or a stretch of a muscle, then proprioception will cause a reflex to take place to protect that part of your body by contracting muscles or relaxing muscles. And maybe we get to talk about that. We might have to wait, actually, to get to the muscle system. So proprioception. Where do you have proprioceptors? In one location or all over the place? All over the place. Even though it kind of looks like a special term, you have these sensors all over the place in every muscle, and probably many even in one muscle. All right, so the general sense of the sensory types, we can break it down into either general or special. And a general sensation is a sensation that you can have all over your body. It doesn't matter. So if I take an ice cube and put it on your earlobe, can you feel that ice cube? Can you feel that ice cube on your earlobe? Yeah. What about if I take that ice cube and put it on the back of your knee? Can you feel it? Back of the knee, ice cube? Oh, we should do this in lab. I have a diversity of opinion here. And I would say if I put an ice cube on the back of your knee or the front of your knee, you'll be able to feel that cold signal right there. What about if we put an ice cube on your belly button? Can you feel it? Yes, you can. Okay. And because you have that sensation all over your body, we call that a general sense. And so you can sense pain all over your body. That's a general sense. Temperature all over your body. That's a general sense. And proprioception, even though it seems like really particular, you have proprioceptors where? In one place in your body or all over? All over. So that is another general sense as a result of that. Okay. So that means that a special sense is you can appreciate that modality of energy only in one or two locations in your body. So again, if we have a flashlight, turn it on and just shine it on your belly button. Can you see that light? No. If we shine it on your shoulder, can you see it? No. If we shine it on your earlobe, can you see it? No. It's only when that light energy enters your eye that you see it. And so vision is a special sense because they only have two locations, right? Your eyes that can appreciate that stimulus. And that is the same for hearing. You can only hear with your ears, not with your patella or big toe, right? And equilibrium is also a special sense, and that's due to some apparatuses inside the ear that eventually we're going to look at. So let's list the special senses. It's not completely listed here. All right, so we got hearing. We have vision, taste, smell, okay, and then two forms of equilibrium, static equilibrium and dynamic or kinetic equilibrium, two kinds of equilibrium. So those are the ones. All right, let's talk about some sensory receptors. Basically, we can break them down into two forms. There's tonic receptors and phasic receptors. Tonic receptor is a receptor that generates an action potential constantly for as long as the stimulus is being applied. All right, so for a tonic receptor, if we apply stimulus and keep it on for a really long period of time, this could even be, for instance, a year. Let's just say a year to be really kind of absurd. Right? This receptor does not tire, does not fatigue. It will produce an action potential, and the frequency of these action potentials is going to be proportional to the intensity of the stimulus. So if we increase the intensity of the stimulus, what can you tell me about these action potentials? Will they get bigger? Will they get bigger? The answer is no. Okay. Will they get longer? No. What's going to change? Yeah, just the frequency, how fast they come along in time. Okay. So that's a tonic receptor. Okay. A phasic receptor, on the other hand, is stimulated the best when the stimulus first applies, and then if the stimulus remains on, then the receptor changes the rate at which it's generating an action potential. Okay. We call that adaptation. So some receptors adapt very well. Like right now, you're probably not sensing the clothes that are on your body, the shoes that you're wearing, because touch is a rapidly adapting kind of sensation, and smell is as well. If you walk into a library, at least from what I can recall, right, libraries have kind of a characteristic smell to them because of all the books that are in there, right, and you go, oh wow, okay, I'm in the library, you know right away. But after studying for 10 or 15 minutes, you don't perceive that sensation at all, right? So smell is a rapidly adapting sensation. Here's something that can be a little bit confusing. It's called the law of specific nerve energies. And you have a couple questions at the end of the book or online. Can't remember exactly where they are. And students have a little bit of trouble with this, so I'll try to describe it pretty adequately. All right. Stimulation of a sensory nerve fiber evokes only the sensation of its modality, right? An adequate stimulus is the normal stimulus that will stimulate a receptor, and an adequate stimulus, right, is, or a receptor will respond to an adequate stimulus because it responds to the least amount of energy that is activated. All right, so what does that mean? So it means that an adequate stimulus is not an amount of energy, it's a type of energy. Right? So you can stimulate an eye with pressure, right? But it's going to take a lot of energy to do that. So that's not an adequate stimulus. But light will be able to stimulate a photoreceptor very easily with low energy because it is an adequate stimulus. Right? So adequate stimulus is a type, not an amount. And sometimes it's a little bit confusing to appreciate. Okay, and you can just look at this table for what the adequate stimulus is for a particular kind of photoreceptor, what particular kind of receptor. Photoreceptor, it would be light. Chemoreceptors, it would be a chemical dissolved in solution. And damage to tissue is going to be picked up by free nerve endings, right, which are pain receptors. These receptors will change membrane potential, right? And we're familiar with changes in membrane potential. And these things sort of look like graded potentials, but if they're produced by a receptor, we call them generator potentials. and the amplitude of a generator potential is proportional to the stimulus intensity. And a particular receptor will do the best job of producing these generator potentials if the stimulus is adequate, if it is of the correct type. Okay? And generator potentials are always going to be EPSPs, and they're produced in response to an adequate stimulus. So if it's not an adequate stimulus, then the intensity of that stimulus has to be way, way high in order for that receptor to generate a potential. Yeah. Yeah. Modality would be a different form of energy, like light is one modality, sound pressure is another modality of energy, and a pressure wave would be another type of modality, different modality compared to light. Okay. So generator potentials are proportional to stimulus intensity, so they're not like an action potential. Right, because action potentials are always exactly the same intensity. And then after a threshold is reached, an action potential is, or the frequency of action potentials is proportional to the amplitude of the generator potential. Right, so if the generator potential is really large, right, it could still be at threshold by the time this action potential reaches this relative refractory period. Right, so that's why we say it's just proportional to the amplitude of the generator potentials. Okay. All right, so let's take a look. Wow, for some reason, I don't know why this slide is here. I have a sense that we talked about this already. I think maybe in the nervous system. All right, so we got three lines that we're going to look at for a tonic receptor. We have action potentials, and of course you know that an action potential should have the same intensity and duration, and nothing is going to change. And then here are some generator potentials that are being produced by a receptor, and then here is an illustration of a stimulus. So this first stimulus is turned on and turned off, and if we look at action potentials, what can you tell me about action potentials? Okay, there are no action potentials, and this is easily understood by looking at this generator potential and saying what? It just hasn't reached threshold, right? So this energy is just going to be ignored. If we increase the intensity of the stimulus, right, then the generator potential increases and it reaches threshold, and as soon as it does, it will produce an action potential. Okay, and then over in this period of time, right, there is a relative refractory period where this intensity of a generator potential cannot overcome that area of hyperpolarization, and so that neuron is going to be quiet until that relative refractory period kind of diminishes, and then that stimulus then can trigger another action potential. Right. If we turn that off and then go to a third stimulus, right, so here we see a really large generator potential, I can see that the frequency of action potential increases compared to the second case over here, because even though the neuron might be in a relative refractory period, this generated potential is so large that it can overcome that area of hyperpolarization after an action potential. So action potential will be triggered earlier in time compared to the second condition over here. So your nervous system really can tell the difference of intensity, right, by the frequency of action potentials. And this slide shows that the frequency of action potentials is due to the amplitude of a generator potential. But don't forget, what is this generator potential? The height of this generator potential is due to the stimulus intensity to begin with, right? So the frequency of action potentials in reality is due to the intensity of the stimulus. This generator potential is just some intermediate form to trigger these voltage-gated channels. Okay, let's get into some special senses. Taste and smell are external receptors because they're responding to stimulus that is in the environment, not inside our bodies. There are interoceptors. They respond to things that are happening inside your body, the internal environment. So taste and smell are chemicals outside our body, so those are external receptors. So the sense of taste, right? You should know if that's a general or special sense. And we know now it is special because if you have a sugar cube and you put your fingertip on it, you can't touch it, right? Put a sugar cube on your earlobe, can't taste it. Only if that sugar dissolves in saliva and enters a taste bud. And another name for taste is gustation. Gustation sense is the same thing as taste. And we can break all taste sensations down into basically five categories: sweet, sour, salty, bitter. And then we have a sense of fulfillment or pleasure when we eat food that's called umami. And each of these taste cells will trigger one of these sensations, right, in our brain. So if we look at this taste bud, okay, what do you see when you look at this taste bud right here? What do you see? I see a nerve ending. What else do you see? Like, what's this dot right here? Yeah, nucleus. I would say nucleus. That's an organelle. And what am I outlining right here? A cell, right. So can you, and so this taste bud is made up of, oh, I don't know, maybe 10 or 20 cells and tips of this neuron right here. So can you see a taste bud with your naked eye? No, you can't. You need a microscope to see, right, at this level of magnification. You can't see this. But, so what I'm trying to point out to you is that there are things on the surface of your tongue that people mistake for taste buds all the time. Those things are called papillae. And a papilla is just loaded with these taste buds. So there's a difference between that papilla and a taste bud. Taste bud is microscopic. And here's a pore. So taste molecules have to enter this taste pore and bind to receptors on these taste hairs. And when they do, that will change the electrical property of this gustatory cell or taste cell. And when it changes the membrane potential of the taste cell, that can then change the membrane potential of this neuron, which will send action potentials to the brain. Right, so, okay, let's look at some taste cells. And we're going to break this down by the taste sensation. This first case over here, all right, I can see some hairs. Basically, you can consider these like cilia. And this particular kind of cell has sodium channels that are open all the time. So they're just open and they're on your tongue. So whenever sodium concentration gets high in your mouth, like when you eat, what do you eat? Yeah, like salt, right? Because salt is just sodium chloride. When you put sodium chloride in your mouth, sodium dissolves in saliva very easily, enters the taste pore. And when it enters the taste pore, it has access to these taste and cells. And here is a pore in the membrane that's open. And so sodium then will move from high concentration to low concentration inside the cell. And as sodium moves in, what do we know that signal to be? It is a signal. It is depolarization. That's always how we understand depolarization. And what is depolarization? Inhibitory or excitatory? Yeah, it's excitatory. Right, and so that is basically the generator potential. Okay, and so there that opens calcium channels. So calcium then enters the cell. Remember, calcium is low outside the cell. And when calcium enters the cell, that triggers a cascade of events that moves these vesicles over to the cell membrane and releases something that looks very much like a neurotransmitter to across the synapse to the sensory neuron. All right, so what kind of channels are these channels, the calcium channels? What kind of channels are these? Okay, because you see they're closed because depolarization opens them. So normally they're closed, they open up. Yeah, so it's a gated channel, but a particular kind of gated channel. And somebody told me it is a voltage-gated channel, right? Not a ligand-gated channel. And that's why depolarization opens these things, because these are voltage-gated channels. Okay. So, in a sense, this part of the taste cell is sort of acting like what part of a neuron? Okay. What part of a neuron is this end of a taste cell acting like? Since it has voltage-gated channels, it's acting like an axon, right? And this end over here, sort of looks like a dendrite, but not quite. All right, so that's for salty. That's pretty easy to understand. Sour, I think we just have to understand what sour is, but sour is a taste of acidity. And what makes something more or less acid? hydrogen ion concentration, right? So there are, in this particular taste cell for sour, there aren't sodium channels, but there are other kinds of channels that selectively allow protons to move through them. So that when you eat something that's acidic, that's of course going to dissolve in water very easily, enter the taste bud, and this proton will go through the proton channel. And what's going to happen to the cell membrane potential when a proton? What's the charge on a proton? Always, yeah, it's a plus one. All right, so what happens to the membrane potential of the cell when a proton enters? Yeah, it depolarizes, and we know that to be excitatory signal. And that depolarization will open up calcium channels. All right, so there are voltage-gated calcium channels. It enters the cell, and that causes neurotransmitter release. All right, so why is it, right? So here we have calcium-gated, voltage-gated channels for calcium here and here. Why is it that we have two different sensations? Right, because, okay, there are different ions, right, but calcium nonetheless is still the intermediary signal that is going to allow you to taste something. Why do we taste two different things when both cells are releasing neurotransmitter due to increases of calcium inside the cell? Because it depends where these signals go in your brain. Okay, so this neuron takes action potentials to a little bit different part of the brain compared to this axon right here. So that will change the modality. All right, the other kinds of sensations that we have, we're going to put sweet and umami together, and then the last one is bitter. Sweet you just know to be sugar molecules, and umami we think really has to do with certain kinds of amino acids. And you know something about amino acids. What are amino acids? Building block of protein, right? So they're around all over the place. In this particular case, a sugar molecule or an amino acid won't enter the cell, right? But that will trigger things inside the cell to happen. And the signal transduction pathway is a G protein coupled receptor. So sugars and amino acids can bind to receptors, right, extracellularly. That will activate a G protein. And the G protein then can affect various kind of channels within the cell. And in this particular case, this messenger right here will close potassium channels. So if you close a potassium channel, that prevents potassium from leaving. Okay, so what happens to the cell then? Yeah, if we maintain positive, right, if we don't let positive charges to escape, it's going to depolarize the cell. So that's a little bit different scheme compared to the first two, but nonetheless, that's going to cause release of neurotransmitter. So this is a special messenger system where the sugar or amino acid is always outside the cell, and that changes some other chemical composition inside the cell. So what in this scheme right here, what would we call a sugar molecule? It never enters the cell, but it can change things inside the cell. That is a first messenger, and this thing inside the cell is a second messenger. So second messengers are always inside the cell, first messengers are always outside the cell, and one really nice signal transduction scheme is the use of G protein coupled receptors. Okay. All right, bitter. Let's look at bitter. So an example of bitter would be quinine. So that kind of that shape of a molecule is going to bind to a receptor. And again, here's a G protein that produces an increase in second messenger inside the cell. And now, in this particular case for bitter, it doesn't open up calcium channels on the cell membrane, but it opens up channels, calcium channels on smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Okay, and then the smooth endoplasmic reticulum releases calcium, because what's calcium concentration inside the cell, in the cytosol? Calcium is almost zero, right? It's almost zero inside the cell. And smooth endoplasmic reticulum is a reservoir for calcium. So if a calcium channel opens, then the SCR will release calcium, and then that will trigger neurotransmitter release. Okay, so these things are a little bit different. And this is an exam figure. Okay. Any questions? Yeah. different areas. Yeah, yeah. Different areas in the brain. Okay, and smell. The name for smell is olfaction. And these receptors are in your nasal cavity. As a matter of fact, the superior part of the nasal cavity. So if you really want to smell something, what do people do? They really want to get a good sense of what's going on. You have to sniff, right? So you got to go, you got to get air up going over these sensory nerve endings. And this is kind of strange because this is the only place in the body where I know there are nerves that are actually dangling outside your body. Right, so these nerve endings are just in your nasal cavity. And so anything that's in the environment will have access to these neurons, whether, and there's a lot of harmful things in air that we breathe. So these neurons are kind of special because they can regenerate. Right? As long as the cells that reproduce them don't get damaged. The cells that reproduce these neurons are called stem cells. So these kinds of neurons do regenerate. So this is just part of the ethmoid bone right above the nasal cavity, right? And the cribriform plate has olfactory foramina, and the olfactory foramina are there so that processes of neurons can move into the brain. And the part of the brain they move into is the olfactory bulb. Right, so if we look at the nasal cavity, there is an epithelium, right, lining the nasal cavity, and I can see some olfactory receptor neurons, right, with cilia or hair sticking down into the nasal cavity, and they'll have receptors. Right. I also see some other kinds of cells, right, that make up the epithelium, and some of these cells will help detoxify what's in the air, and some of these cells are stem cells that can differentiate into neurons, right, when the olfactory neurons die because they're just living in the wrong place, right? They're, part of them is outside your body. Well, this is sort of interesting. These stem cells produce new receptor cells every 1 to 2 months. That's pretty interesting. These neurons, I didn't realize that. These neurons get replaced every 2 months. They get regenerated. The sense of smell all act through G-protein coupled receptors, and unlike the taste receptors, there are thousands of different kinds of receptors, all coupled to G-proteins. So it's a much more complicated system, and scientists will be talking about how we can classify these different sense sensations for a pretty long time. Right, probably the most important thing is to just realize that they work through G-protein coupled receptors. All right, so that takes us to hearing. A little anatomy. Let's see, do I have a picture of an ear right here anywhere? Ah, let's start right here. This might even be a better illustration than the, what's in your textbook. So if we think of the ear, we should think of that it has three main areas, right? There's an outer ear, a middle ear, and an inner ear. And the organs for sensation are in the inner ear. And the middle and outer just aid in acquiring information for a particular modality of energy. So the inner ear is responsible for hearing and two kinds of equilibrium. And that's why this structure looks so complicated. And we're going to talk about hearing first. All right, so sound is an energy. It's a pressure wave. It's not like light energy. It's not an electromagnetic wave. It's a pressure wave. And that pressure enters the external acoustic meatus, and the auricle here helps funnel some of that energy into this tube. That energy bounces up and down on the tympanic membrane, vibrates the tympanic membrane back and forth, and when it does, it vibrates the auditory ossicles that are in the middle ear, and that carries those vibrations to the oval window, which is the entrance to the inner ear. All right, so in order for you to hear something, you need an outer ear, a middle ear, and a properly functioning inner ear as well, right, for the sense of hearing. Here is that nice eustachian tube or auditory tube. Sometimes we call it the pharyngotympanic tube because it goes to the middle ear, and where does the other end open into? If you call this the pharyngotympanic tube. The Pharynx, that's right. What's another name for pharynx? Your throat, right? Your throat. Okay. And this tympanic membrane will only vibrate back and forth if the barometric pressure is the same on either side of it. If the pressure inside the middle ear gets really, really high, it's going to push the tympanic membrane all the way out to the left, and then when sound pressure hits it, it won't be able to vibrate back and forth. And if the tympanic membrane can't vibrate back and forth, can you hear anything? No, then you can't hear anything, right? So this eustachian tube is a way to equalize pressure, just air pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane. And for instance, what else? Well, maybe you're up in the mountains and then you come down to sea level where air pressure is a lot higher. That air pressure is going to push the tympanic membrane into the middle ear, right? And then when normal sound bumps into it, again, it can't vibrate back and forth. And typically then what happens to restore your normal hearing? Okay, you might hear like a little wheezing sound or something, or you can hold your nose and pressurize your nasal cavity, and that will force some air up through the eustachian tube to help equalize pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane, and then all of a sudden you can hear a lot better, like when you're driving down from the mountains. Okay, so these are auditory ossicles. They're really, really small. Malleus, incus, and stapes. So for hearing, you need all three of these areas. All right, so let's go back. I lied. Okay, I still want to talk about something. Okay, inside the inner ear, there are three main areas for different sensations. This thing that looks like a snail, this thing that looks like a snail is called the cochlea. Oh, it's nicely labeled, cochlea. And that's the part of the inner ear responsible for hearing, the cochlea. We're going to get into it a little bit more detail. The vestibule is this bulge right here. And there are receptors there for something we call static equilibrium. Static equilibrium is a way that you can perceive your head position, whether your head is upright or if your head is facing down. Okay, there are receptors that can tell that. So it can sense gravity. Which way is gravity pulling on your body? The third area are these tiny canals. We call these semicircular canals. And remember, they're circular, so fluid can flow around and around and around and around and not go anywhere because it's a nice circle. These are responsible for something we call dynamic equilibrium or spinning. All right, so let's go over that again, make sure I said it right. Semicircular canals for the sensation of spinning, which is called dynamic equilibrium or kinetic equilibrium. And for gravity, the vestibule can sense the pull of gravity. We call that static equilibrium. And then the cochlea is for hearing. And we're going to talk about some sense organs inside these three structures. So if we look at the cochlea, vestibule, and semicircular canals, there is what we call the bony labyrinth inside the temporal bone. Right, so the bony labyrinth is cochlea, vestibule, semicircular canals, and now we got to go inside those things to see what's going on. All right, so let me go back. Okay. All right, so here is that. Here is the bony labyrinth, and the equilibrium sense will come from the vestibule or the semicircular canals, and we're going to talk about the vestibule. It has a couple sensory receptors called the utricle and saccule. Each one is called a macula, right? So you have two maculae inside the vestibule for static equilibrium or the pull of gravity. And these things, of course, are in the inner ear. Let's take a look and see what's there. Okay, utricle and saccule. It has cells. So here are some cells. And the cells have cilia that poke straight up. And the cilia are surrounded by something that's kind of fluid, kind of reminds me of vitreous humor a little bit, kind of a sticky substance that can deform pretty easily. Gravity can, maybe a gelatin would be a good way to describe this thing. And sitting on top of the gelatin are crystals, calcium carbonate crystals. So those are a little bit heavier than the gel itself. Those things are what we call otoliths, and the crystals are important for this sense of equilibrium because they push down on the cilia. So if somebody is standing upright, these otoliths are pushing straight down on the cilia, and you know what? They don't bend one way or the other. But as soon as somebody tilts their head forward, then these crystals pull down on that gelatinous mass, and when it does, look what happens to the what we call stereocilia. They start to bend. All right, so it's just a mechanical deformation of the cilia that changes the membrane potential of this particular hair cell. And it's a hair cell because of the stereocilia, not because it really grows hair, right? Okay, so if there's a change in voltage properties or membrane potential of this hair cell, that's going to change the frequency of action potentials going to the brain to understand what position the head is in. Okay, so you have utricle and saccule, and both of those things are what we call a maculae. A little bit better view of looking at this. Let's zoom in to the top of a hair cell. Here are the stereocilia, and they get bent. Now, why do these things get bent once again? Because they're embedded in that gelatinous mass with crystals on the top, right? So it sags or moves around with gravity, and depending on how they bend, right? So if they bend forward, that is going to close sodium channels. If they bend backwards, they're going to open sodium channels. And so that's either going to inhibit or excite that receptor cell. And that's going to just change the generator potentials, which is going to change the rate of action potentials going to the brain. Okay. So I was thinking of a good word to describe static equilibrium. Okay, static equilibrium is a way that you can perceive linear acceleration. So what the heck does linear acceleration mean? Let's start with acceleration. Does anybody have an idea of what acceleration means? And linear is easy because it just means a straight line. But what is acceleration? Okay. Yeah, okay, so for instance, that was really good. When you're driving your car and then all of a sudden you stop, you kind of get leaned forward in your seat because your body keeps moving. All right, so an acceleration is a change in speed or a change in velocity. So the vestibular apparatus cannot detect a constant velocity, but if you change velocity, for instance, when you're stopped and you start, or if you're moving at a constant velocity and you start, then this apparatus can detect that. That's what acceleration is. And linear acceleration is detected by the utricle and saccule. The other kind of equilibrium sense, we call dynamic or kinetic equilibrium, senses spinning or angular acceleration. Right? And again, if you want to think of acceleration, so if you're spinning at a constant rate, right? The semicircular canals can't detect that. But if you start spinning from being stationary, the semicircular canals can detect that. Or if you're spinning for a long period of time and stop, then the semicircular canals can detect that. But not when you're spinning at a constant rate. So here is the bony labyrinth. Inside the bony labyrinth is a membranous labyrinth. And inside the membranous labyrinth, there is a fluid that's very much like cerebrospinal fluid that we call endolymph. So there is fluid, and it's that fluid that can actually flow through the semicircular canals. And it's the fluid that sound moves through when it's in the cochlea. Okay, so the utricle and saccule look like this with otoliths. In the semicircular canals, right, so utricle and saccule are here in the vestibule. You've got three semicircular canals, and there's a sense organ for each of these different canals. And they're called crista ampullaris. So if you look at just one semicircular canal, you can see there's a bulge at the base of each of them. Okay, and that reminded somebody of a little glass vial that maybe contains medication or something in, and that's called an ampule. And so they call this the ampullaris, and the crista ampullaris is the organ on the inside. So let's take a look at the crista ampullaris within the ampulla of the semicircular canals. Here is the membrane. It has support cells, and it has hair cells, and we can see the stereocilia projecting up into something, again, that has a gelatinous mass to it. So here's a little gelatin, and it can bend backwards and forwards. And it's surrounded by endolymph. All right, so if you're not spinning, the endolymph is stationary, and the crista ampullaris is stationary. And as soon as you start to spin, since the crista ampullaris right here is attached to your head, it's going to start to spin as well. But what about that fluid that's inside the semicircular canals? It's not really attached to anything, right? It's going to stay stationary for a period of time, and then it's going to press on this gelatinous mass and bend the hair cells. All right, so why is it that this fluid is not moving? Because it's a property of matter, it's a property of mass. And that property says that if there is a mass and it is stationary, it has a tendency to remain stationary, right? But if mass is in motion, it's going to have a tendency to stay in that state of motion, right? And that is what we call inertia, okay? Inertia, so mass has inertia. If a mass is not moving, it wishes to stay stationary. If it is moving, then it wishes to continue on with that particular motion. Right, so because of inertia, when a person starts to spin, the endolymph stays stationary, right? But the cupula right here is moving, then the gelatinous mass is going to be pushed one side or the other. And if you spin for a long period of time, right, then the endolymph starts to spin with your head. The endolymph starts spinning with your head, so that if you all of a sudden stop, the crista ampullaris stops. But what about that fluid inside the semicircular canals? Because of inertia, it keeps spinning around the semicircular canals and bends the stereocilia the opposite way. And so again, only when there is a change in the rate of spinning does the crista ampullaris send signals to the brain. And that's why if you get up and spin around and then stop all of a sudden and look, you'll see the room spinning around you because of inertia of the endolymph. Okay, so those are the two senses for equilibrium. And what part of the ear is necessary for those two senses of equilibrium? If we look at, what part of the ear? Remember the three parts, outer, middle, and inner. It's just the inner ear, right? So you can have a completely destroyed middle ear and outer ear, but you still could have a perfect sense of equilibrium because that's in the vestibule and semicircular canals. All right, now what about hearing? What parts of the ear are necessary for hearing? All three, right? The outer, middle, and inner ear, and the cochlea in particular. Okay, so the way that we characterize auditory or pressure waves is by the amplitude and also by the frequency. The amplitude is related to intensity, and the frequency is how many wavelengths occur in a particular period of time. And it's a pressure wave. That frequency is measured in cycles per second, and a cycles per second is the same thing as a hertz. And if you want to put a capital H right there for hertz, that's fine. There was just somebody that first described what a sound wave looks like. And the pitch that you hear is related to the frequency of that particular wave. And the faster the wave moves through the ear, if there's an increase in frequency, and it sounds like a higher pitch. If it's a very long wave, it sounds like a low frequency pitch. And so there are different parts of the ear that are stimulated. All right, so here is the cochlea, and it's all unwound. Remember, the cochlea kind of looked like a snail, so if we unwind the snail, it just looks like a straight line. Here I see the pharyngotympanic tube, so this is the middle ear. Here is the outer ear. Sound energy bumps up against the tympanic membrane. It vibrates, and it vibrates these auditory ossicles. And then the stapes acts like a plunger. It's pushing on a membrane and injecting that pressure wave into the fluid of the cochlea. Okay? And so that membrane underneath the stapes is called the oval window. That's how sound energy enters the cochlea. And that sound energy definitely could damage the cochlea, but there's a way out. And the way out is through the round window. So sound is going to travel through the cochlea and exit through the round window. So we got a couple parts to the cochlea. There is this top part right here that we call the scala vestibuli. There is the bottom part that we call the scala tympani. And then there is this middle part right here, right? And we're going to call this the cochlear duct.
Where is it labeled?
Cochlear duct, right here. Okay, and there are cells that can sense these different waves of pressure as they move through the cochlea. The fluid that receives the sound energy is called perilymph, but there's still endolymph within the cochlear duct. All right, so sound will enter, and depending on the frequency, it will move across the cochlear duct. Right, so if it's a high-frequency energy, it will move across very close to the oval window. If it's a really low-frequency sound, then it's going to travel into the cochlea. It's going to penetrate a little bit more deeply before it moves across the cochlear duct. So depending on the frequency of that sound energy, different parts of the cochlear duct are going to be vibrated. And that might seem kind of mysterious, but there is a relationship between the size of an object and the frequency at which it likes to vibrate at. Can you think of any example where different pitches of sound are produced based on the size of an object? You all probably could think of a bunch of things. Like, for instance, how does a piano work? Because it has strings that vibrate back and forth. But are all those strings the same length and the same thickness? They are not. They're different sizes. Same thing for a violin and a guitar, right? The strings have a different shape. So depending on the shape, which is the length and thickness of that wire, they're going to have a different characteristic frequency. So the cochlear duct is not uniform. The cochlear duct is the largest over here toward the end, so it is the one that vibrates the easiest with low frequency. The cochlear duct is the smallest over here next to the oval window, so it has just a natural tendency to vibrate at a high frequency, and then in the middle, right, will be like mid-range frequencies. Down below the cochlea, we see the distribution of how different frequencies, right, 500 is a really low frequency, 2000 is almost like speech, maybe a little bit higher than speech. 20,000 is a really high frequency, and maybe some of us can hear that, but that's a really, really high frequency. So we see that the high frequencies stimulate this proximal end of the cochlear duct, low frequencies more out to the tip, and that tip is what we call the helicotrema. All right, so here we see a nice cochlea. Why is it all wound up like this? I tell you what, before we think about that, let's go back to this unwound cochlea right here. So depending on what part of the cochlea, right, is going to respond to different kinds of pitches. And that reminds me of a musical instrument that's kind of flat like this, and depending on how you stimulate that instrument, you can get low notes placed on one end, and you can produce high notes on the other end and mid-range frequencies in the middle right here. What kind of instrument does that remind you of? Okay, that reminds me of a piano, right? Piano has keys, and as you move from side to side, the pitch changes. The keyboard is kind of the reverse, right? Low frequencies are over here on the piano, or the long strings are over here, short strings are over here. But just think of a piano. So why in nature is that cochlea all wound up like that? Well, it has to have this length, right? Just like a piano has to have a certain width to get all those frequencies in there, right? If the cochlea wasn't all lined up, then you would have this something that looks very much like a piano sticking outside your head, right? So it rolls up so that it fits inside the inner ear. And there is a corresponding part in the temporal lobe that will receive action potentials from each of these individual areas of the cochlea. And so again, there is something that looks very much like a piano in the temporal lobe, and it fits in the temporal lobe really nice, so it doesn't have to be coiled up. It's just a nice linear area within the temporal lobe. Okay, so how does that work? Well, here's the scale of vestibuli, and we said that's connected up to the tympanic membrane. So sound energy enters the scale of vestibuli, and depending on the size of the cochlear duct, okay, then this is going to vibrate. If it's at the particular characteristic frequency, then this part of that ear is going to vibrate. The sound then is going to enter the scala tympani and then lead through the round window. All right, so let's zoom into this region right here. Okay, so we've zoomed in, so don't forget, we're looking at the cochlear duct. This thing, and I see some hair cells, right, and I see some nerves leaving, and again I see something that looks very much like a gelatinous mass. We call that the tectorial membrane. The tectorial membrane touches the stereocilia on these hair cells, and when it vibrates, it changes the electrical properties of the of these auditory cells, which then changes the frequency of action potentials going to the brain to the temporal lobe. Okay, so you got the tectorial membrane, and that's in the endolymph, right? And then you have perilymph right over here, endolymph on either side of it. So, and sound will move across. If the shape of this this thing right here, we call the organ of Corti. Organ of Corti contains these hair cells that are stimulated by that particular frequency of sound. I'm not so concerned about this pathway. But here you can see, okay, the temporal lobe, and this is the primary auditory cortex in the temporal lobe. So high frequencies will stimulate this part of the auditory cortex, low frequencies will stimulate this part, and you will hear different pitches depending on where those action potentials go. All right, so what happens if the frequency of action potentials changes in this part of the temporal lobe? What are you going to perceive? The frequency of action potentials is related to the intensity of the sound. So as the sound gets larger or louder, as the sound gets louder, the frequency of action potentials to this particular part of the brain increases. Okay? As the sound gets softer, then the frequency of action potentials to this part of the brain decreases. So we see axons from nerves from the organ of Corti, right, enter the medulla, and it goes into this structure right here. Part of the midbrain, there is something called the corpora quadrigemina, and that just means four bodies. There's two superior, two inferior colliculi, and this is the most inferior pair called the inferior colliculus. This thing is responsible for auditory reflexes in the sense that, right, so the right and left side can share information. This is the part of the brain that can localize sound. So for instance, we have four doors in this class. With your eyes closed, if somebody were to open and close the door, you could tell which one it is, right, by using this inferior colliculus. Because if on my left, if that door opens and closes, the sound from that door will reach my left ear before the right ear. And it seems like a really short period of time, but the inferior colliculus can measure that period of time, and then you get the sense that that sound is coming from the left side of your body. Okay? And then depending on where the sound comes from, right, the inferior colliculus will be able to figure that out. All right, so the colliculus doesn't hear anything, it just knows where the direction of the sound. So that's pretty important too. And I think that's pretty much it for hearing. and for vision. Okay, so what did we talk about? Gustation, olfaction, hearing, and two forms of equilibrium. We talked about five special senses. So here's the last one, or the sixth one. So vision, you have receptor cells that can transduce electromagnetic waves into action potentials. So light is a wave, but it's a different kind of wave than a sound wave. A sound wave is just a mechanical pressure wave moving through air, but light is an electromagnetic wave. It doesn't change the pressure at all. It's just another form of energy. And depending on the frequency of that energy or that wave, then we can perceive different colors. So what I see down over here, right, is just the visible spectrum, and it should look just like a rainbow. And it's electromagnetic radiation, but it's only a very small spectrum of all of the electromagnetic waves that are around us. And that's what's shown on this first line over here. Okay. And so we can't see infrared or microwaves, but it's basically the same kind of energy, just the wave length has changed. All right, so how is it that we can see these different colors? Okay, so there are some structures that are primary visual structures like the retina that can perceive these different colors, but there are some accessory structures as well that allow the retina to work properly, or maybe these structures protect the eye. Right? And one thing right here is the iris. The iris changes the diameter of the pupil. So this dark spot right here is the pupil, and it can change diameter. So it can constrict or it can dilate. When it constricts, it lets less light into the eye. When it dilates, it lets more light into the eye. And there are two different kinds of smooth muscle fibers that are involved in this. I can see some circular muscle fibers here, and then I can see some radial muscle fibers here and here. And they're controlled by the autonomic nervous system. Right. If the circular smooth muscle contracts, right, then the diameter of this pupil is going to get smaller. Right? Just like if you're to contract your orbicularis oris, your mouth is going to close. Right? If you contract your orbicularis oculi, your eye is going to close. And if the circular muscles of the iris close, then the pupil is going to get smaller and smaller and smaller. And so under what conditions would that happen? That would happen under bright light that restricts light from entering the retina and that protects the retina. This is under the parasympathetic nervous system control. The circular muscles are for parasympathetic nervous system control. The opposite, right, when the radial fibers contract, they pull on the circular fibers and that increases the diameter of the pupil. Right, and that's under sympathetic control, which are those two parts of the autonomic nervous system that we just looked at. And that makes perfect sense because when you're in a stressful situation, right, then you'd want to get as much information into your eye so that you can see what's happening around you. All right, so in anatomy, how would you like to classify the pupil? What kind of structure is this pupil? So what am I thinking? Is it something like a fossa or a process or a spine or what kind of thing is this? It is just a foramen, right? It's just a foramen in the iris. And what's the function of a foramen? It's a passageway. I think I heard somebody say passageway, right? And in this particular case, it's a passageway for light. It moves through there. And it's a very clear substance, and because it's so clear, that's why it looks dark. The iris, on the other hand, blocks light, and when it blocks light, it will absorb some colors, and it will reflect others, and so different people have different colored irises, just all depending on what part of the visible light spectrum it reflects back to you, and what part it absorbs. All right, so that is... Okay, so that's for adjusting the intensity of light. Right, so how is it that we see something? Okay, in order to see something really nice and clear, right, an object is going to emit light rays, And those light rays have to be focused on the retina. And when light passes through different kinds of media, it is refracted or it is bent, but also the shape of that media changes how much the light is bent. And so here is something that we can see that is bending light. That is what we call a lens because of its curvature. As the curvature gets greater, it bends light to a greater degree, right? And as it becomes flatter, it bends light less. Well, it just so happens when light is coming from a place that's really close to you, the light rays are moving apart very fast. And so in order to get those light rays focused back on the retina, they have to be bent a lot, which means that this lens right here has to have a lot of curvature to it. But when light is this one right here is bent more. Okay. But when light is coming from a far distance, the light rays are not spreading apart very fast, so they don't have to be bent quite the same amount to focus on the retina. So the lens has to be thinner or not have as much curvature. So there's a process where the curvature of the lens is changed, right? From going from being thick to having a large curvature to thin with less curvature, and that process is called accommodation. So accommodation is a way that you can change the place where you focus your vision, either close up or far away. Right, so that's different than what's happening within the iris. So the lens has to change shape. It doesn't have a muscle associated with it, but there are muscles inside the eye that can pull or relax tension on the lens and change the shape of the lens. And again, that's another circular kind of muscle. And in anatomy, we learned that was the ciliary body or ciliary muscle. And it has ligaments that attach to the lens. Right, so this is a little bit strange. Okay, when you think of a skeletal muscle and a tendon, what is a tendon attached to? It's a muscle-to-bone connection, right? So what happens to tension in that tendon in the normal skeletal muscle when the muscle contracts? So let's contract our biceps brachii. It's going to adjust tension in a tendon. Okay, is it going to increase or decrease tension in that tendon? Okay, it's going to increase tension in that tendon, and then your skeleton is going to move around as the tension increases. Well, this system is a little bit different. Right? Because for skeletal muscle, tension increases when the muscle contracts. Because this is a circular muscle, right, when the muscle contracts, okay, that's when the tension of the suspensory ligaments is released. Because when the circular muscle contracts, the diameter of the circle decreases, and that reduces the tension of these suspensory ligaments. And when the tension is reduced, then the lens gets thicker because it's not being pulled. This top condition over here, right, I can see that the ligaments right here are really stretched out. It has a lot of tension placed on them, and that happens when the ciliary body relaxes. When a circular muscle relaxes, the diameter gets larger, and that produces more tension on the suspensory ligaments, and that pulls on the lens, making it flatter. All right, so that's kind of a different way to think about what muscle can do. And this is a smooth muscle, not a skeletal muscle. So you have no way to control this. And that process of adjusting your length of focus is called accommodation. Right? And has anybody ever experienced accommodation before? I probably should have had you do a little experiment to know what accommodation is. And that's just a law of physics. Cameras have to do this. People have to do this. And so, I tell you what, take your fingertips and put them out in front of your body pretty far away and focus on your fingernails or your fingertip. Right? Just focus really carefully on that. And what can you tell me about the background? It's blurry, right? Now, keep your fingers right there and focus on the background. Do you see your fingertips? No, I see about 20 of them, right? Because they're defocused. So you can only focus at one distance at a time, and that process of changing where you focus is called accommodation, right? And so what muscle is important for accommodation? It is the ciliary body. What part of the eye is responsible for accommodation? It is the lens, right? Because it can change shape. All right, when we look at this eyeball right here, there is something else that looks like it's a lens. It has a lot of curvature to it. Right? Do you see anything else that light passes through that has a lot of curvature? And it's not the foramen. It's not the pupil. It is the outer covering of the eye right here on that anterior pole, anterior surface of the eye, which is the cornea. Right? So here I see a lot of curvature. That bends light as well. As a matter of fact, it's the cornea that actually focuses light to a greater degree than the lens does. The lens doesn't help you produce a sharp image overall. It is really the cornea. The only job of the lens is to accommodate, right, to change that distance. And so the shape of the cornea has the most focusing power to it. Right, so let's look at this. There are different ways that eyeballs will work depending on their shape. So if light is entering the eye, it gets bent by the cornea and it gets bent by the lens, and I see that it gets focused at just this one point, which means, and it's not shown on this illustration, which means that this light actually came from just one point, right? So light came from one point and it starts to spread out, and when it enters the eye, those light rays that are spreading out get focused back to one particular point. And if it's nice and sharp, right, then that's really normal vision. We call that emmetropia. And if you're seeing perfectly like that, then you don't need any kind of corrective lenses. All right, so if we look at this eyeball, this point is, and we don't change the lens or the cornea, it's just fixed at this particular distance from the lens. Right, but if we change the shape of the eyeball, right, the eyeball itself, and make it longer, where is light going to focus? It's still going to, and we don't change the shape of the lens or the cornea, it's still going to focus here. But if the eyeball moves all the way back over here where the retina is, then the light rays are going to start to bend apart again, and you're going to have blurry vision as a result. So if somebody's eyeball is too long, okay, I can see that light is going to focus in front of the retina and then defocus by the time it reaches the retina. So this is what we call nearsightedness or myopia, right? And the light focuses in front of the retina. And in order to correct for that, we need a concave lens. Right? So what that does is that it spreads out these light rays. So when it's overcorrected, it now focuses at a distance farther away from the lens. Right, so that's myopia or nearsightedness in front of the retina. Hyperopia or farsightedness is when the eyeball is too short. Right, so the lens and cornea have the same curvature compared to these situations over here, but the eyeball is shorter, so now the retina moves in front of that point where light rays are focusing. And so we call that farsightedness or hyperopia. To correct for that, we need to start bending the light rays together more quickly before they enter the eye. That's done with a convex lens. Right, so the convex lens starts to bend light before it enters the eye, so now it can focus at the proper spot on the retina, which is at a shorter distance compared to the first condition we were looking at. Astigmatism. All right, all these conditions that we were looking at so far presume that the lens is a nice circular structure and the cornea is a nice circular structure and that the curvature is the same no matter where you look on that particular circle. All right, so the lens on the top is the same thickness compared to the bottom. And the thickness of the lens does not necessarily have to be that way. Some people will have a lens that's thicker on the bottom than the top, which means then that the focusing power on the bottom is going to be different than the top. And no matter if you put a convex or concave lens in, right, that can't correct for the asymmetry of the lens or asymmetry of the cornea. And that's what we call astigmatism. So an astigmatism, let's look down over here. Astigmatism is when somebody looks at an object And if it's in a plane, just a flat surface, something in that surface will be in focus, but in another location, it will be out of focus. If somebody has farsightedness or nearsightedness, if you're looking at a planar object, or if you're looking at a plane, that whole plane will either be in focus or not in focus, the whole thing, all at once. With astigmatism, it's just one part of that plane, because different parts of the lens will have a different shape. All right? And if that's the case, then the lens has to have a different shape. Right? And so there has to be different amounts of curvature produced by this lens, which then compensates for differences in curvature of a lens depending on where you look at it. That's what we call astigmatism. Okay. All right, so what does, in lab you talk about some of this stuff, I don't have any slides on this, but what does 20/20 mean? Did you guys talk about eyes yet in lab? Okay, 20/20. Well, 20 means 20 feet. Okay, and 20/20 is normal vision. There's just a standard chart that has certain size letters on it. And at 20 feet, if somebody can read the letters, right, they have 20/20 vision. And if somebody doesn't have very good vision, they're going to have something called 20 and then a larger number, like 20/100. What the heck does that mean? Okay. If they have 20/100, that means that when they're standing at 20 feet looking at an object, it seems as if they're standing 100 feet away compared to the person that has normal vision. Right? So a normal person would have comparable vision if they moved 100 feet away from the chart that they're looking at. Right? And if somebody has 20/200 vision, right, then compared to a normal person would have to be 200 feet away from that object, and they would have the same sharpness of vision. Okay. All right, the retina, that's the photoreceptor part of the brain, or of the eye. Do we have a picture of the eye? No picture of an eye. Okay. Well, we'll use this one. I think from anatomy you can remember three layers of the eye. The outermost layer is the toughest, and that's the sclera. The middle layer is called the choroid. That's the vascular layer. That's where we have blood vessels. And then the third deepest layer is the retina, and that's where photoreceptor cells are. Okay, so remember that the choroid has blood vessels and the retina does not. And why is it a good idea that the retina does not have blood vessels? Because it has photoreceptors for light, and if there's a blood vessel there, then you don't have photoreceptors. So if there's blood vessels in the retina, then you'll have a blind spot in the eye at that particular location. Right? But normally people don't have blood vessels growing up into the retina. Under certain circumstances, that can happen. For instance, like for premature babies, what do we do with a premature baby to help them breathe and help them maintain temperature and keep really good tabs of their heart rate and that kind of stuff? Yeah, we put them in an incubator, right? And because their lungs, depending on how premature they are, their lungs are not developed, they're immature, and so they don't function properly. And a lung is a doorway for getting oxygen inside the body. And if it's not working, oxygen isn't getting inside the body quite like it should. So what would be one way to increase oxygen delivery to the inside of that infant? By increasing the concentration of oxygen in the air they breathe, or you could think of maybe increasing the percent of oxygen in the air they breathe, or the pressure of oxygen, right, that they're breathing. But anyway, you increase oxygen, right, and so oxygen will have a greater tendency to move by diffusion into their body. So not only does oxygen diffuse into their blood, right, but it diffuses into their eye as well and moves across the vitreous humor, and now you have a high oxygen concentration in the retina, and oxygen is a stimulus that promotes the development of blood vessels. All right, so blood vessels will then start to grow into the retina of those babies that are in an incubator. And that's called retinopathy of prematurity. And it took a long time to figure out why some individuals had vision deficits or were blind. Okay, but then they figured out that that high concentration of oxygen was causing the growth of blood vessels into the retina. And so now it's a kind of a tough call to figure out, well, what does this infant need to stay alive? So you increase the oxygen concentration up to the point where it's beneficial to them, but not so high that it causes development of blood vessels into the retina, right? And that's what we call clinical judgment. You get to figure that out. All right, so here is what the retina looks like. This is where the vitreous humor is. So light is coming into the eye through the vitreous humor. And right, so here I see the sclera. I see blood vessels in the choroid. Right, so this is the superficial part of the eye. This is the deep part. The photoreceptors are buried pretty deep within the retina, which I think most people think is a little bit strange. I would have thought that these photoreceptors are very superficial, that light hits them first. Right, but that's not the case. Light has to pass through all these different layers of neurons before it gets to the photoreceptor cells. If we look at the photoreceptor cells, you can probably see that there are two different types, right, based by their shape. This is sort of an okay diagram, not really good, but it's good because I see some cells that have a pointy tip and some that have more of a blunted tip. The one that have a blunted tip looks more like a rod. The one that has a pointy tip looks more like a cone, and that's how these cells were named, rods and cones. They have different functions. And the cone cells are responsible for color vision. The rod cells cannot see color. They can only see grayscale, differences in black and white. So not just pure black and white, but differences in black and white we call grayscale. And they're in different locations of the retina. Cone cells are in the central part of the retina, right? And the rod cells are more in the periphery for peripheral vision. And then there's another difference too. Maybe I see it on this slide. Ah, this is a better slide. Okay. Because now I can see that the cone cell is smaller compared to the rod cell. And because the rod cell is bigger, right, it is more sensitive to light. Right, so if the same amount enters the eye, it just so happens that the rod cell can collect more of it compared to a smaller cell, which is the rod cell. So there's a trade-off between these two cells. The cone cell can see nicely in color, but you can see color only in bright light. Rod cells, you can only see grayscale, but they work in dim light, like what we have right now. Because the cone cells are smaller, they can give you a nice sharp image. The rod cells, because they're bigger, will give you more of a blurry image. And where you have rod cells is near the center of your vision, which we call the fovea centralis or the macula lutea. But as you move away from those areas to the periphery, then rod cells kind of take over and you just have black and white vision in that area. All right, well, I need to say a little bit more about rods, okay, next time. Okay, just got a couple slides. Try to look over this a little bit because this is a strange kind of system, how these rod cells work.